If the election of Donald Trump was an earthquake, his accomplishments since are the aftershocks no one saw coming. From best-selling author Stephen E. Strang comes Trump Aftershock, the seismic impact on culture and faith in America. Trump Aftershock offers unique insights that will cut through the media noise and reveal what they won't tell you. Gain a better understanding of the political, emotional, and spiritual dimensions at work in Trump Aftershock. Available where fine books are sold.
Welcome to the Strang Report with Steve Strang on the Charisma Podcast Network. This episode was produced to discuss and address issues within our nation and around the world from a Christian worldview.
Hello, everyone. This is Stephen Strang, and welcome to the Strang Report. Today, I am so honored to talk to Doug Weed about President George H.W. Bush, who he had the privilege of serving in the White House. And all of us are still mourning the loss of this great president, this great American. And I was able to track down Doug Weed after all these years, who I've known since 1968, as I recall. So first of all, let me welcome you, Doug.
Hey, thank you, Steve. What an honor to be with you.
Well, thank you. I've known you since you were a teenager. You're related to my, should I say, spiritual mother, Joyce Strader. Her husband, Carl, was my pastor in that era. And you were an up-and-coming evangelist, as I recall, and writing books about Catholic charismatics and things like that. And in my world, you were a big, big deal.
and controversial.
Yeah, in your own way, you were controversial. I remember that you published a magazine called Restoration, which I actually came across in my archives not too long ago. It was kind of interesting after all these years to look at it. And, you know, you were reared as I was in the Assemblies of God. Our fathers actually worked together for a number of years and, you know, obviously knew each other well. I knew your parents, who are great godly people, and you just have a very interesting family. But then you did something that very few Pentecostals have done, or at least done successfully. You got involved in politics, which kind of will lead us up to George H.W. Bush. Can you tell me how that happened?
Yeah, I guess nowadays they call it crossover. But at the time, before Amy Grant and singers started to crossover, I was really drawn by the Holy Spirit to play their game, so to speak. I remember when I was writing one of my books, there was a great opportunity to write something deeply spiritual about one of the presidents, and I felt a real check. I felt the Holy Spirit saying to me, look, I got plenty of people who can write this book for Thomas Nelson. I want you to write this book for Simon Schuster and keep your foot in the door, and I'll tell you when to speak up. But until that time comes, keep your mouth shut. So that's what I did, and I encountered amazing antipathy towards Christians. I think they know it's there, but I think they would be staggered if they knew how calculated and how terrible it is, the bias against Christians in corporate America and now in the techno-monopolies. And it's very interesting. Jesus predicted it. He said, they'll hate you because you're mine.
Well, I would think that most Christians would be aware of that today, but you and I are talking about, what, the 1970s, of when you were beginning to be aware of this? Can you describe what you ran into?
Yeah, I remember Jim Watt. He was the Secretary of Interior under Ronald Reagan, and he was a born-again Christian. And when he was being considered Secretary of Interior, they brought him into a Senate hearing, and they basically said, well, if you're a born-again Christian, how can you be Secretary of Interior? You believe Jesus is coming again. Why would you want to maintain the parks? Why would you care about the environment? That's the sort of bias and ignorance people had towards evangelical Christians. But usually they wouldn't let you know. They wouldn't ask the question publicly. They'd whisper it in the hallways amongst themselves and just blackball you. But I wrote a history book, and my agent, who was gay and who worked for a major agency, tried to get it placed and came back and said, hey, you know, it's your religion, your faith. One of the TV networks has never had me on to this day because they determined what my faith was very early on. All the others have had me on.
And so how did this lead to you getting involved with George H.W. Bush's campaign?
Well, I first met him at a charity, and he didn't know my religious faith. He just knew me from the charity. So we got to know each other, and we worked on some charitable projects. He made a trip to Africa. He did some other things and asked for my help. And one day I'm sitting in his office with he and his press secretary, Pete Teeley, and we're just sitting there talking, and the vice president stands up and he says, "Fellas, I got to go. I got to go speak to the national religious broadcasters." And Teeley, who was Catholic, said, "Well, Mr. Vice President, Doug here is a born-again Christian." And the vice president sat back down and he said, "You are a born-again Christian?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You are a born-again Christian?" I said, "Yes, you got a lot of them around you. Susie Baker is a Catholic Pentecostal." He said, "Susie Baker? That's Jim Baker's wife." I said, "Yes, they're all around you, Mr. President. There's a lot of people who..." He said, do you have time right now?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Come with me. Go with me to this National Religious Broadcasters." So we're riding over in the motorcade to the Sheraton Hotel, and he says, "Look at my speech here." And I look at his speech, and I'm saying, "Well, if you want my opinion, you know, you're quoting Thomas Dewey here," and you're... I said, "Yeah, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that?" So it became apparent he needed a little course on evangelical Christianity if he wanted to build a relationship with them, and he was very grateful for that. He was a patrician, New England Episcopalian. He couldn't afford to let people know that he didn't know anything about one of the greatest religious revivals of our generation, but by the same token, he desperately needed information so he could connect and relate, and so that began a process, and I wrote thousands of pages of memorandum. He wrote back little notes.
And so you're describing when he was vice president, is that right?
That's right. And when I was writing these notes to him, he was taking action based on what I was recommending, things he was saying, things he was doing. And Steve, I had a very clear feeling that he's vetting this with somebody. He's not just going to take my word for it and do something. There's somebody else, a third party, and I assumed it was Billy Graham. So as I wrote my memos, I thought, well, this is going to go to Billy Graham, and Billy Graham's going to come back and say, "Well, that's right," or, "Oh, I think he's wrong here." So I soon learned after the fact that he was vetting them with his son, George W. Bush, who had come to the Lord in Texas. And his son was writing back and saying, "That's right on. That's exactly, that's how it works. That's how they think." And so I was writing his memos to the father, but in fact, I was also unknowingly writing them to the son.
That's interesting. And, you know, I knew you back in that era, and I have a recollection of certain things. One of them is the campaign in 1988. Ronald Reagan was term limited out, of course, and George Bush went on to win that election, the first sitting vice president, I think, in almost 150 years to win. But in that election, Pat Robertson ran. And I remember that what sticks in my mind, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is that you went to the Bush people and you were saying, you know, remember the thing about the Russians are coming? You were saying the evangelicals are coming, and they didn't really believe until Pat Robertson started getting some traction, and that gave you a lot of credibility with them. And then I remember that you wrote a list of all the leaders, kind of who is who, I guess, to tutor him on this segment of the population. Is my recollection even close?
That's absolutely accurate. All of that is accurate. There was a whole series of memos entitled Targets, and we wrote up the biographies of 1,000 evangelical leaders. You were one of them. And he would study those biographies and which particular branch and why and how and what their career was and their usefulness. So all of that was true. And early on, as a young evangelical, it was a time, Steve, when Baker and Swaggart and Robertson and all of the major ministries of that time were carving up the same dollar. They all had big projects, demanded huge donations to fulfill those projects, and something was going to give. They couldn't all do what they said they were going to do. There wasn't enough money. So the dollar was being carved up, and they were very protective of their mailing lists. And people gave within their group. If you were a Pentecostal, you didn't give to a Southern Baptist project. If you were a fundamentalist Baptist, you didn't give to a charismatic project. They all gave within their group, and they protected their mailing lists, guarded them with their lives. But when James Kennedy, a pastor in Florida, came up to the Capitol steps with his choir and they sang a patriotic song, it resonated across all of the barriers and boundaries of Christendom that it divided us in those days. And all of the major religious leaders realized there's one way they can reach everybody, and that's when they go patriotic or when they go to the government, talk about who's going to lead the country as a government. So all of them got very patriotic. Jerry Falwell was never involved in public life till that time. So I did write a memo that said, I predict some major religious leader is going to run for president of the United States because that leader, whoever it is going to co-opt everybody's mailing list. They're going to have, it's just like they break into your office and find your computer and get all your names. That's what will happen because everybody born again in the country is going to support that person when they're under fire in the national debate. And when I wrote that memo, all my enemies in the Bush campaign who didn't like me because I'm an outsider and I'm a Christian, and they made sure the vice president saw that memo. Lee Atwater ran that in. You got to see this, because they thought it was the most ridiculous and absurd thing they'd ever seen in my life. So you were right on the money. They rushed it right to his desk. Here, we think the religious leader is going to run for president. Ha, ha, ha. So Pat Robertson emerged and ran for president, and I looked like a genius. And I wasn't a genius. I was just an Assemblies of God boy who could see what was happening.
That's an interesting story. I remember meeting George H.W. Bush through you. It must have been around 1985. He was still vice president. He was, I guess, testing the waters. And he was in Orlando for some reason. And I have a picture, thanks to you, and Carl and Joyce Strader in the background of the picture. So it must have been a fairly small group, and I guess he was just trying to get support for later for running. I actually shared this in a podcast, and if my listeners didn't listen to it, I encourage you to listen to my own recollections. I won't take more time up here except to say that when CBA, the Christian Booksellers Association Convention, which was a big deal back in that day, was in Washington, D.C., there was a meeting with a bunch of CBA people at the vice president residence at the Naval Observatory. And I'm assuming you put together that group of people. There must have been 75 people there. Do you remember that meeting?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I did put it together. We spent a lot of time on those meetings and had to vet all the names and develop strategies for all those people. And it's quite a lot of work.
And this was the early stages of him kind of wooing the evangelical vote. He ultimately, of course, got the nomination and won the presidency. And you were suddenly an insider, and you were given a job in the Bush White House, which was a great, great honor. What was your title? And it seemed to me that you served for about 2 years, up until right at the time of Desert Storm. What was it you did in the White House for President Bush?
Yeah, that's correct. I was Special Assistant to the President, and I handled all religious groups, and I handled law enforcement groups, police unions, veterans, all of the veterans organizations. There was a long list, all the conservatives and conservative groups, immigration issues. I'd have to look at my notes to see all the groups that I worked with, but I was in charge of those groups and building a relationship with them, and answering the correspondence, writing the letters for the president that he wrote back to those people, and setting up meetings in the Roosevelt Room and the Oval Office, and deciding which conventions to go to and what to say at them. And so it's a tremendous amount of work.
And I remember getting to visit the White House a couple of times, always at your invitation. Thank you very much. And it was just a very interesting time in history. And then suddenly you were out. And I remembered that we were trying, you know, of course, this is before the days of the internet and all that kind of stuff. We were somehow limited in how we could get out the word. But I can remember trying to figure out how to kind of expose the shenanigans that were going on behind the scenes. But then the Gulf War started, and suddenly all attention was what was happening in the Middle East. And your story was kind of buried. Am I remembering that correct, too?
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, the average length of stay, you're right, it was about a couple of years. The average length of stay is a year and a half on senior staff. So when I hear of these people turning over in the Trump White House and everybody's acting like that's never happened before, I think, well, that's the way I remembered it was. That's the way it is. Disraeli, the British Prime Minister, called power climbing that slippery pole, he called it, or greasy pole. So you make enemies. You don't want to make enemies, and you can be nice to everybody and agree with everybody, and there's still going to be people hate you just because you're there and they've got somebody else they want in that spot.
Well, you've had a very interesting career and an interesting life, and you know the reason I wanted to talk to you this week was because of the recent passing of George H.W. Bush. And our podcasts are usually fairly short, so I'm going to ask you if you do another podcast with me in which we could remember more about this president, the kind of man he was, what you remember, some of your interactions with him. So with that, I'll wrap up this edition of the Strang Report and encourage the listeners to tune in tomorrow to hear the rest of the story about George H.W. Bush from Doug Weed. Thank you for listening. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to The Strang Report with Steve Strang. To read more from Steve, visit his blog, The Strang Report, on charismamag.com. Again, it's The Strang Report on charismamag.com.
This has been a production of the Charisma Podcast Network. Steve and Joyce Strang are the founders and owners of CPN. Dr. Steve Green is the executive producer of the Charisma Podcast Network. We intend to honor God with every podcast and remain thankful to our advertisers and supporters who make these podcasts possible.